You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's show, North Korea solidifies its pariah status by testing a hydrogen bomb, or so it says. If true, how does it affect the geopolitical calculus? And how might its neighbours respond? Then we continue our look at the recent diplomatic spat between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And we'll head to America to look at the fallout of Barack Obama's big gun control push. All that, plus a chat about Europe's refugees, and much more, starting right now on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House, and my guest today are Xenia Wickett and Ivor Gaber. Xenia is director of the US program at Chatham House here in London, and Ivor is professor of journalism at the University of Sussex, both regular Monocle 24 contributors. Welcome both to the programme. Now, let's begin today's conversation in North Korea, where the government claims it successfully conducted the country's first hydrogen bomb test. Much criticism and also some scepticism has emerged following the announcement, though if true, it would be Pyongyang's fourth nuclear test since 2006. Xenia, everybody seems to have been slightly alarmed by this, and not least neighbours, Japan, South Korea, China too. What do we make of the regional reaction, first of all, especially from China? It seems genuine consternation at the unruliness of what's happening in Pyongyang.
I think you've just put your finger on, to some respects, kind of the most interesting part of this. The first question, and we'll dismiss this, but, was it a hydrogen bomb? There's a lot of people saying, actually, the size of the seismic response wasn't big enough to be a hydrogen bomb, so there's many doubts in that space. But what is clear is that they did test a nuclear explosion, if you will, and that goes against UN Security Council, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What is really interesting to me is China's response and what it means for North Korea and international engagement with North Korea. I mean, China has long been North Korea's really only friend. They give it significant amounts of food, energy, etc. If China were to pull the carpet out from under Kim Jong-un, then North Korea, he would be unlikely to last terribly long. China doesn't want to do that, of course, because they're absolutely terrified of the repercussions in terms of migration, refugees that they would have to deal with, and then, they could potentially have the West right on their borders, so they don't want North Korea to collapse. But what you're seeing here again, and we've seen this over the last couple of years really, is China just looking completely befuddled and stressed about how they can deal with a North Korea that is led by somebody who appears to have absolutely no interest whatsoever in taking any kind of direction or being restricted by China's desires.
Ivor, when we look at this narrative, what's interesting, John Everard, who is often on the show, former North Korean ambassador from the UK, I heard him commenting this morning saying there's a strange thing in North Korea that they genuinely feel that everybody is out to get them and that they could pull the trigger one day, because they have this sense, that if they should pull the trigger first rather than wait to be got because everybody is out for them. How dangerous do you feel this situation is?
Well, I have to say, it seems to me we're dealing with a leader who is sort of unknowable, and those who get to know him don't seem to hang around too long. So we're dealing with a difficult situation. I mean, if I was to be very cynical, and I'm not, but if I were, I would say, I just wonder if with all of the tensions and problems in the Middle East, they felt they were sort of missing out on some of the international attention and thought they'd get involved as well. I mean, there is a pattern here. I think it's every time this happens, there's lots of bellicose words. There might be a little bit of shooting across the border. There has been in the past. And then it calms down again. And it seems to me that we have a situation where the existing alleged, apparently tense status quo sort of works for both sides at the moment. And it seems to me the North Koreans want to maintain the tension without going OTT, and The fear is, of course, they will, because we're not dealing with necessarily particularly rational regimes. But I pick up the point about China. I think their confusion is perhaps the most interesting aspect of this whole issue.
So if we'd cut back 20 years, we'd have been looking to Washington and asking what Washington was doing in these circumstances. You know, the trade in wheat and, you know, helping North Korea in times of starvation. There was a lot of to and fro on the diplomatic front. These days, the American response seems to be almost non-existent.
Well, you still have the 3+3 negotiations that include the United States, include Russia, China, South Korea, Japan, and I'm missing one. Maybe the UK. Apologies. But you still have the 3+3 negotiations, but they're just not going anywhere because North Korea doesn't want to negotiate. So America is still involved. People still look to the United States to take action to see what their response is. Obama pretty much throughout his term has said, look, we're not giving something for nothing. We've been there before and it hasn't worked. So this time we're not giving something to nothing. But what, you know, back to, you know, the China angle, what is so interesting is, to some respects, we've always expected China to be able to bring North Korea to the table. And increasingly, China doesn't look able to bring North Korea to the table because North Korea doesn't show any interest in doing what China asks of it. And so there is a real question today, less about the nuclear test itself, but more about, do we truly now have a country that has no friends, that we have no effective diplomatic link to try and lower tensions, alleviate tensions, and take a step forward? And if that is the case, then I think you're always right. We just kind of shrug and say, we can live with the status quo as long as it doesn't get any worse.
In the past, you know, many, many years ago, sitting in Europe, we had little Albania, which was one of these isolationist states. And we had the same kind of expectation that, you know, that communist neighbours would be able to pull a few ropes and Enver Hoxha would maybe kind of like do our bidding. We've learned, you know, they didn't have anything like the threat to the outside world that, you know, that North Korea has. But in the end, it turns out that, you know, yeah, there may be a bit of kind of shared kind of belief in communism in the background there. But actually, China and actually North Korea are beginning to believe in very different things these days.
Well, my experience of working in China over several years, mainly with journalists, is that Chinese nationalism is much more important than communism. And similarly, I think, having not worked in North Korea, I suspect North Korean nationalism is more important than ideology. And I think that seems to me to be, unfortunately, because I don't think nationalism is a particularly positive thing, the driving force of most world conflicts today. I think the age of ideology is almost dead, and I don't think that the Chinese, okay, they have a notionally communist system, but they have a very capitalist economy, more broadly speaking. And it's nationalism that is driving these interests. One thinks of the disputes over bits of rock in which China and Japan are currently contesting. That's about nationalism. And I think that's how we have to view this. And that's why it's problematic, because there are no natural allies for the North Koreans.
Well, in a very tough week for diplomacy, we should now turn to another story, which is the continuing diplomatic spat between Saudi Arabia and its regional neighbour and rival, Iran. It's bad news for the region, given that both countries remain behind some of the Middle East's most prominent wars in Yemen, Syria and elsewhere. So how might this crisis begin to play out? Zen, you know, we've watched, you know, it's one of these fascinating situations over the last two or three days. Another situation where we felt that the outside players had some influence, maybe the Russians with the Iranians, the Americans with the Saudis. Again, those old diplomatic ties don't seem to have worked in the way that we thought. But we're being told today that actually, don't worry about it. When it comes to the talks around Syria, we're going to forget all this. We're going to sit around the table. Can that be reality?
It absolutely can be reality. I mean, there are lots of countries, most notably the Russians and the Chinese, who are very good at compartmentalizing their foreign policy. And, you know, so you can engage with them on one issue and entirely disagree with them. I mean, a great case in point is you know, Russia over Syria has been engaging with the West for 2 years, and yet we've been fighting a fairly strong propaganda war and more during that period as well. So, I mean, the idea that they can sit at the table together, yes, as long as there are common mutual interests, everybody wants to be at the table, everybody wants to solve the problem, then it can happen. But I think that you're you know, you the identification of the fact that you have this, the fact that we would think that somehow as Iran enters the international community and regains its footing in the international community, that everybody is going to sit back and let that happen, was a wildly optimistic view and held by a number of people who are now, I hope, waking up to the fact that actually there are a lot of countries led by Saudi Arabia who are, terrified is too strong a word, but who are absolutely resistant to the idea that Iran could regain its footing and could actually start to compete and be a regional hegemon. And they will do everything in their power. And so there is a real sense that what has happened over the weekend with the killing of the kind of senior Shiite
the cleric, Nima al-Nima.
Exactly. With, one wonders how much of it is actually about that and how much of this is actually about creating a story that allows Saudi Arabia to then get all sorts of countries behind it and do everything it can to keep Iran down.
Can I just pick up on that? It's an interesting point. I'm trying to remember the name of the Saudi spokesman who, I'm coming back to nationalism, we know about the Sunni-Shiite split, but the Saudi spokesman said the other day, yesterday, Saudi will not allow a non-Arab country to dominate Arab countries. He was talking about Iranian influence in Syria, in Iraq, one other, escapes me, Yemen. And I thought that was an interesting way of interpreting the current split, that Saudi, okay, there is clearly the Sunni-Shiite split, which is very important, but the Saudis formulated it in terms of Arabs against the others, so to speak, and that reminded me of the discourse in the Iran-Iraq war of many, many years ago.
But this is, if I may, this is even more than that. I mean, this is great power politics. I mean, we've spent the last, I don't know how long, decade plus, talking about great power politics between China and the United States. But this is great power politics between the Saudi Arabia and Iran. And I think that what we're seeing is that great power politics start to play out. And this is what we actually need to be coming up with policies to try and allow what is inevitably, if Iran continues to live by the deal, the nuclear deal that was signed, and that moves forward, and Iran does regain its position on the international stage, there will be a transition, a power transition, and we need to find ways to actually help all of the countries in the region and beyond manage that transition. That's extraordinarily hard.
Well, I think it's fascinating what you said, that there is this, you know, obviously the notion of this kind of archipelago kind of politics and foreign policy where new players rise up. But it's not, it was also interesting to see today that, you know, you feel it's a bit of a disconnected story, but oil hit an 11-year low today, and we know who's turned on the taps to make sure that it does hit an 11-year low. That's the Saudis. They have used oil as a powerful weapon to knock the Iranians. And it doesn't seem to be a huge coincidence that these two things are almost happening at the same time. Just on that level, Zenya, what do you make of this oil game as well?
Well, I mean, I have to say, I think the Saudis are keeping the taps turned on because they don't want to lose market share. And, you know, they're worried with Iran, Iraq, with others coming back, with the shale revolution in the United States. So they are going to lose market share. And at the same time, as you rightly put it, by keeping the taps on, they keep the price low, which hurts Iran. It also, by the by, hurts Russia quite a lot as well. I think it's not going to work, because are they able to stop the small producers in the United States from investing? Absolutely. 5 years from now, price goes up, they'll be investing again. So this is a, you know, long game for the producers, and the Saudis are trying what is effectively a short-term strategy to keep market share. It isn't going to work, but it is actually serving Western interest and the Western consumer quite nicely for the time being.
And just tell me, what do you make of the US kind of connection? Because, you know, we've seen some condemnation at the UN. You know, they were upset about the attack on the embassy, but there wasn't a huge amount of support for killing 40 odd people who are in Saudi jails. And interestingly, you get the perspective with, you know, the gun story that we're going to come onto in a moment. You know, that Obama kind of sees the kind of light at the end of the tunnel, him leaving power, and he's kind of out to do the right thing at the moment, do the good thing, and he didn't seem that keen to kind of jump to the support of the Saudis.
There are so many aspects of this when you start talking about the United States, but the one that I think kind of stands out, you know, the for President Obama, the nuclear deal was a huge legacy. So the Democrats don't want to talk about any of the negative effects of the nuclear deal, which is to say there's going to be tensions between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and how do you manage that, and that needs to be engaged upon. So the Democrats don't want to talk about that story because actually this is just a good news story, and the long-term implications being more troublesome, they don't want to talk about. The Republicans don't actually want to talk about this because actually this is a long-term problem, and that makes it not terribly politically palatable. They like the short-term stories. And so you don't have the Republicans or the Democrats talking about it. The American people just want to stop talking about the Middle East. And actually, American policymakers, in many respects, the non-Middle East experts, just want to get back to what they consider to be the strategic agenda, which is Asia. And so you've got an awful lot of people in the United States that just want this to go away. That's a real problem because America has huge potential to actually unintentionally, through ignorance, cause problems. I don't know that it can do much to make it better, however, which is probably why they're keeping their mouth shut, apart from anything else.
Ivor, so you want to jump in?
The lack of a major dominating power in the Middle East, it has been a major problem, because in the past, whether it was for the last two decades, it's been the United States, at least were able to, if you like, to hold the ring in one sense or another, not to everybody's satisfaction by a long chalk, but nonetheless, there was a dominating power. Prior to that, the Soviets and the United States both struggled for sovereignty or influence. Now, okay, Zena's talked about Iran and Saudi being power politics, but that's a very unstable notion compared to what we had in the past. And until the Middle East is very difficult to be optimistic about, and in the absence of any dominant power, it's even worse. And I think the United States' pullback, as you're describing it, contributes greatly to the instability.
Ivor, we're going to, of course, bring Xenia on this story as well, but we're just talking about Barack Obama. We've seen this very, very emotional speech at the White House. You know, his attempt to bring in some gun controls at last. Do you think he stands a chance?
Well, we were discussing before we went on air the intricacies of American delegated legislation, as we call it here, the ability of Congress to block the president's initiative. And in theory, it probably will end up in the Supreme Court, and look how long it took to get Obamacare through. But I do think it depends on what happens in the presidential elections. I think if the Democrats, and presumably Hillary Clinton, but nothing is certain in this world, come in with a thumping great majority, and there is a sense of politics moving in a different direction in the United States, then I suspect it will eventually go through, just as Obamacare did, but it will be a long, hard battle.
So, yeah, I know you're going to have lots to say on this, but I do also want you to mix in and give me your views on this standoff, this Bundy standoff we're seeing in the US. You know, how can it be in America you have all these people with guns holed up, doing what they want, TV cameras, no one kind of doing a thing? You get one black guy on a street in an American city, he'd be shot dead in 5 minutes. How have they got to this situation where you it's extraordinary, isn't it?
So let me say something about that, and then go back to the gun control more broadly. I think this is fascinating, and I think this is incredibly smart of the FBI. So the FBI are the people who actually are in control, as it were, of the government response to the Bundy, and they're just sitting back and saying, "You guys are just going to muck it up." Actually, right now, we can do nothing. It's going to become a non-story, and then we can do something further down the road. But we're not in any urgent hurry to do something. So I actually think the strategy is a very good one. In terms of the gun control, I mean, I am made very nervous by the use of executive order, because it's all well and good when you agree with what the president is doing, but if you disagree with what the president is doing, then it becomes really, really scary. So I'm not a big fan of executive order. On the other hand, there's only two other ways that this can move, that we can move forward on gun control. And I think most kind of sensible people, including those who hold guns here in the United Kingdom, actually feel like this needs to change. It's either through federal legislation or it's through state and local legislation. It is clear that nothing is going to happen through federal legislation. So the states are moving on it. The other way is through executive order. We're going to be doing all of these things. And the reality is that once they get done, I suspect that even if they are not done through legislation, through Congress, they will still continue to be enforced over time.
But both of you, quickly, when you look at the situation, just a snapshot before we move on, effectively, when you look at what he's trying to do, he's kind of saying people who are mentally ill or crazy or have used guns in domestic violence, we shouldn't let them buy more guns. How can anybody kind of be opposed to that?
But well, this is why, sorry.
Well, I was going to say, I don't agree with this, but I can hear somebody saying, just because somebody's mentally ill doesn't mean they don't have rights under the Constitution.
But actually, it's not even that so much. There is a real fear amongst the kind of National Rifle Association and others that this is a slippery slope. If you start down this slope, we're just going to keep going down that slope. And so many of them will say, yeah, you're right, you know, excuse me, but people who are mentally unstable shouldn't have access to guns. But the minute you actually have a database, then you have a problem as far as they're concerned. And so I do think that what you're seeing from the states, some states are putting in place legislation that restricts how guns can be used, how guns can be sold, et cetera, et cetera. You are going to see piecemeal movement in a positive direction that will actually eventually become, in decades, probably something sensible.
We're going to take a short break now. We're going to be back in just a second.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Tokyo, our bureau chief is Fiona Wilson.
You know, Tokyo is fantastic. It's a very grown-up city. You know, it's not a sort of superficial love for Tokyo. It grows, and that's what's really kept me here for so long. So it's just great to live here. Fantastic. I love it. I never get sick of it.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to a very fast-paced show here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, I'm changing my own name. Still with me are Ivor Gaber, Professor of Journalism at the University of Sussex, and Zainia Wickett, Director of the US Programme at Chatham House. Now let's turn to Germany. Two connected stories here. One, the announcement that nearly 1.1 million refugees arrived in the past year in Germany. Is that a significant number in a way? Because I wonder how many of them are still there, how many have moved on. It's the arrival and what kind of people is... That big number doesn't tell the full story, does it, Ivor?
If you compare the million to the 20,000 over the next 5 years that the UK is committed to taking, it's a big, big number. And it's difficult now to see how... Well, clearly, I think Mrs. Angela Merkel wants to close the doors, so to speak, but even last night I watched television pictures of refugees tramping through the snow now en route, they hope, to Germany. So a million might not be the end of, well, is not going to be the end of the story. It's a big, big issue which is going to dominate Europe.
And last year was approximately, it was just under half a million, and the year before that was around 200,000. So this is a number that is creeping up. Well, not creeping. It is doubling, has doubled every year for the last 3 years. What this tells you is there's two solutions to this. I mean, one, you have to do something about the refugee crisis. There's no question. And, you know, I think the, you know, Eva's kind of implicit... Maybe we in the UK might need to do more. It's probably what you have to do has to be a European-wide thing. But you also have to actually do something about what's going on in the Middle East so you don't have an awful lot of people and in Asia actually needing to ask for asylum in Europe because they have no opportunities where they live.
Now, there was this both horrifying and interesting story that broke. Well, it didn't break. That's the problem. It happened on New Year's Eve. Some thousand people who are believed to be migrants, maybe not just recent ones, gathered in Cologne on New Year's Eve and sexually assaulted up to 100 German women who were gathered, who were coming and going through the train station. Now, first of all, it seems that the media organisations felt very uncomfortable reporting this because of the people involved. And then the police also felt that they couldn't really take action and they would kind of, in a way, encourage the women to go away rather than tackle this group. that is not good news for anybody, is it? That's that because it plays into every kind of bad story. Something should have been done. What's your take on it, Ivor?
Well, I mean, one of the other sidebars, if you like, aspects of this is that the mayor of Cologne, a woman, didn't blame the women, but said to women, have to take care and be careful, which has added yet another aspect to it of blaming the victim, so to speak. I think it's a very unfortunate development, irrespective of whether the men involved were migrants, first, second, third generation. The very fact that they appeared to be from the Middle East or Turkish or whatever is just going to increase the pressure on Merkel and help Pegida, the anti-immigration body, and it's just added to the tension. And I think it's a dreadfully unfortunate circumstance.
But is there, Zainia, and we all feel a little bit uncomfortable about this conversation, but is there a conversation to be had here? You don't let it get into the hands of Pegida. You say, OK, it's interesting, there's all these people coming here. You have to sign up to something. You have to sign up to, you know, how we treat women. You know, the fact is, you know, that in German schools, they've been saying to kids, don't, you know, young girls, don't come to school wearing skirts, wear trousers, because it's provocative for the new people who have just arrived here. But who should be bending in whose direction?
One tries to move away from shoulds in life, I think, as one gets older. I'm not sure that there's who should be moving. The reality in which we're living today is we have huge refugees coming from parts of the world who have a different cultural mindset to us. It is very, very easy to say you're coming to our country and therefore you have to live by our standards. And at some level, that is the natural thing to say. But you know, I spend a lot of time talking to people from all sorts of different cultures, and there's things that I do or say differently when I'm talking to them because I want to respect theirs as well.
But you're not in their country. I do think the point that when I visit, when you visit a foreign country, we try and adapt to the
laws of
that country.
But let me ask you a question. As a woman, you know, if I go to a country in the Middle East that requires me to, you know, historically, certainly, always walk behind the man, should I live like that? And the answer many people would say is no.
But
that doesn't live up to my standards.
But in Germany, if you're a 20-year-old German woman, should you be thinking, from now on, it's my duty to stand at arm's length from men and that I shouldn't be on my own out at night in central of Köln because, you know, that's because our society has changed?
I think we have to respect and understand one another and where one another's coming from. I think that's where it starts. I'm not going to get into the shoulds of who should compromise and who shouldn't compromise because I actually don't think that's terribly valuable. You know, I like to run. You know, my mother always taught me, if you're running at night, don't run somewhere that there aren't lights. Because you know what? There are bad people everywhere in the world. So I have changed my behaviour to reflect the environment.
I wonder, you know, if this had been 1,000 white German men who had gathered in Cologne and attacked 100 women, I don't think there would have been any holding off of the debate of what should have been done. Those 1,000 people would have been arrested. And something would have been done about it. And, you know, and this is, you know, I do wonder that we're getting a bit caught up in the kind of niceties of it without kind of acting.
Well, it's a complex issue. I'm not sure you're right. It's my understanding of the events that happened, it was very fast moving, New Year's Eve, and I'm not sure the police were totally on top of the situation, irrespective of the ethnicity of the rioters. Put that to one side, clearly police government authorities do tread very carefully on these issues. But just as let me give you an example, which seems to me a very vivid one. In Western society, we frown upon people for good health reasons, apart from taste and decency, of people spitting in the street. I think it's right that that is discouraged, even if it is common practice in parts of the Middle East or wherever. And for people to be cautioned and advised it is against the law to spit in the public seems to me not just acceptable, but the right thing to do.
I think it's also unfair on all of those people who are migrants who have moved to the country and have kind of like have made a great go at it. Then they're suddenly thrown into this kind of group of guys. It's, you know, I think we've got like 10 seconds. Go for it.
No, I think education is a very, very important part, but I think everybody needs to be educated.
Well, Zainia, thank you very much for keeping to 10 seconds. How about that? Well, that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks to Zainia Wickett and to Ivor Gaber. Thank you very much for joining us for a really interesting discussion. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Gaia Lutz and also by Eugenie Derez. And our studio manager was, well, not Chris Chilvers, but someone else I can see behind the glass today. For the next half hour, Carlotta Ribello will be keeping you company with Monocle's international playlist. And at 1900 hours, it's the Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. And at 2200 hours is The Monocle Daily, the show. Well, it's going to be back at the very same time tomorrow, of course, which is 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye for me. And thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.